Hi, and welcome to Gen X Temporaneous. This is a podcast where I come up with an idea, I do some research, I grab a bottle of wine, I bring everything to Mark, and he pontificates. In today's episode, we are going to get into a little bit of a conspiracy theory that may have some basis in fact, or at the very least, one that is quite compelling, and it would be kind of cool if it was real, and that is the simulation hypothesis. Popularized in its current form by Swedish philosopher Nick Bostrom, the idea that all existence is a simulated reality has roots deep in history. Mark and I are going to take a couple of episodes to meander through this subject, and today we will start out by sketching out a rough history of this concept and exploring where the hypothesis stands today. We are so grateful that you come to listen to us each week, and if you do like us, we'd appreciate it if you would share us with a friend. Hi, Mark Snedeker.
Hello, Christina LaRusso. I'm a little busy right now. I'm camping the spawn point.
What the hell?
That's how we win in this game of life.
Oh, my God. I was going to say Mark Snedeker, if that's who you really are.
I mean, who knows? Or am I just a bunch of pixels?
You are a bunch of pixels. All right. Well, this is a subject that you and I have been kind of exploring in person for a while now. We've been chatting about it.
Yeah, I keep testing you, like poking you with sticks and stuff to see if you're real.
No, but
I turn around real fast to see if you finished rendering.
But give me, you know, just a little hot take about your thoughts on this.
Sure. So simulation theory, I mean, it's interesting. Basically, it's pretty well embodied in the movie The Matrix, but there's obviously a lot of different versions of it. But basically, that what we're experiencing right now ain't real, right? It's not what they call base reality, whatever that is. We're possibly experiencing, you know, some simulated universe because it's a game, or we're figments of some greater being's imagination. But basically the idea is that what we experience is not real.
Mm-hmm. And what's your hot take on that?
I kind of divide it up a little bit. First, I would say I 100% agree that we do not experience base reality directly. And that's very easy to accept because we know that our perceptions, which is how we get information about the universe, are flawed. The way things look to me may be different from the way it looks to you, certainly different from the way it looks to Mozart. So in that sense,
the dog, not
right. Well, composer. Also the decomposing composer, possibly. I definitely believe that we do not directly experience unadulterated base reality. Mm-hmm. It's filtered through our own sense data, our prejudices, our beliefs, whatever. So I do believe that, but that's not exactly what simulation theory people simulation hypothesis is probably more accurate, as you previously stated, is not exactly what they mean. So I would say that I think that there's two possibilities, because certainly there are a lot of compelling arguments to be made in favor of the hypothesis, and we'll discuss some of those as we go. But there's no real direct evidence of it. Indeed, it may be impossible for us to have direct evidence of proof that we live in a simulation. It's not really an evidentiary claim, in my opinion, although some people certainly disagree with me. They're not quite as smart or as charming as I am, but they believe this thing. So I think it's more likely that these phenomenon that we think kind of lead us to think that we live in a simulation is really just a way of us misunderstanding the universe. I think that the mathematics that lead us to believe it's a simulation could also be used to lead us to believe that we just don't understand the nature of reality, and that the nature of reality, while it may be unavailable to us, does exist, and we exist in it, we just can't perceive it accurately. Or, of course, simulation theory could be correct, and we live in some kind of bizarre artificial universe created by some greater being or a group of greater beings or some other phenomenon.
For me, my hot take really is,
I think you're all in on it.
I like the idea of it. Yeah, I think that it's possible. It sings to me.
Yes. So why do you like it, though? See, to me, I have the exact opposite reaction. I would dislike living in a simulation like that.
I can't really give you a full answer. I think that I'm going to come to that.
Just a cool idea.
I think that I'll come to that conclusion as we have this conversation and we dig into it. The way I see this conversation going is spanning a couple of episodes, at least. I want to start out kind of in your wheelhouse, which is philosophy and the history of the concept. Because as we've learned together and as you pointed out to me, this concept is not a new concept. It's existed through time, over across millennia. The way that it exists right now and the theory that we're going to kind of jump off with when we get to how is it today was something that was postulated by a philosopher, not a scientist, a philosopher working, I think, at Oxford University. And he's Swedish, though.
Yeah.
Nick Bostrom. And he's the guy who's kind of come up with this hypothesis that scientists are actually engaging with.
Sure.
So physicists and other kinds of mathematicians are engaging with this hypothesis. And as you said, there are some that really buy in and say, and here's how we think we're going to get to the truth of this. And others say, no, no way. And that conversation, that academic conversation is a very interesting conversation. And I want to do that justice at some point in a future episode. But so right now, why don't we get into it and start talking about the history of the concept? Let's talk about the origins of this concept that we're not living in a reality. We're not, this is a simulation. Now, they would have used different words for it.
Certainly.
And in my research, and correct me if I'm wrong, because you would know this because, of course, this is, as I said before, your wheelhouse.
I mean, I really am just a noted expert in the field.
No, a philosophy, because this is all rooted in philosophy. It kind of is rooted in skepticism, no?
Yes. So throughout time, various philosophers have called into doubt the reality of our being, of our existence. Some do it as an exercise to then, kind of strip away all of their prejudices and presuppositions and then rebuild the world, which is what Descartes did. Some of them theorize that this is just how shit is. Think about Plato. Right? Plato in the cave. Obviously, he didn't make that leap to say, not only do we only experience the shadows on the wall of the cave, but it's only shadows on the wall of the cave. There's nothing casting the shadows, right? Not only is it a common philosophical position, but it's a common philosophical exercise to kind of call into question existence and then see if you can't do your best to kind of rebuild it.
Let's talk about how this fits in with skepticism, though.
Sure. So skeptics, basically, as the name implies, doubt knowledge. They think that sense data and scientific knowledge and induction and deduction should all be viewed skeptically. Assume that it's not correct and then see if there's something that is compelling to convince you otherwise. So a skeptic would say, well, the sun will come up tomorrow. And they're like, not only is that a trite Broadway song, it is also you're relying on induction, which is very unreliable. Just because the sun has always come up in the morning, as far as we know, unless we're being fooled by our sense data, doesn't mean it will tomorrow, right? You could say, I've seen every single crow I've ever seen is black. And you can say that leads me to believe that all crows are black. But the skeptic would go, well, no, you don't know that. All you know is that all in your limited experience, you've only seen black crows. Guess what? Maybe tomorrow the albino crow shows up and your theory is destroyed. So that's why you shouldn't rely on induction. And they would say even deduction can lead to a false sense of reality. So they may even say in extreme cases that reality is and truth is essentially unknowable.
Okay. And so some ancient philosophers used this way of thinking and way of being. For them, it wasn't really just a theory. It wasn't just a test about a test of how to, test an argument. it was a way to live because they felt that it brought them peace and happiness.
Correct.
Why would that bring you happiness if you don't know that anything? And well, and there's a faulty thing in that argument, right? You don't know anything except that you don't know anything.
And how do you know that? Right. And believe me, as a freshman philosophy student, we all chirped up with that. And they're like, shut the fuck up. We're trying to teach you about Purell, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, shut up, dude. Nobody wants to hear your little bullshit AP thinking. You know? You're in college now. So you're going to listen and take some fucking notes.
But why do you think that would be? Like, why is that? Well, because I think that if we have this conversation, this might help me get to why I feel good that this is sure. a simulation.
So one way I can imagine that it would be somewhat satisfying is we really do have a lot of anxiety and drama around the argument about who is right about things, reality, mm-hmm. how to behave, what life is, you know, lofty philosophical ideas, religion, etc. So we all think our position is right, and we constantly feel assailed by those who disagree with us. I know I do, but luckily I'm always willing to gird my loins and go to war with them, mostly online, or I can't get hurt. But so I can see that you might have a sense of peace if you just kind of accept the fact that we don't know shit, right? We just don't. And that's just how life is. And, you know, make the best of it and mm-hmm. stop worrying about whether you're right or wrong. You're almost certainly wrong. And there could be a certain amount of peace that comes with that. Now, for someone like me, that is not peaceful at all. I don't find that, you know, reassuring or soothing in any way.
You like to have black and white. This is very much shades of gray kind of thinking, isn't it?
It's not even that. It's like, we don't even see the screen. We don't have no idea if it's white, black, or gray. Could be any or all or none. We don't know. For me, I have strongly held beliefs.
You're skeptical about some things.
I think skepticism in general is a good idea. You know, I achieve this with varying degrees of success, of course, but I don't believe that you should believe anything that you don't have what I would term sufficient reason to believe, mm-hmm. which means on balance, is this the most likely case? Mm-hmm. And once I find what I think is the most likely case, I'm all in until something shows me that, oh, maybe your strongly held beliefs are bullshit. Mm-hmm. Now, that has never happened. But I'm sure it could happen. Mm-hmm. I'm open to the possibility. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I'm skeptical about certain claims, especially spiritual and religious mm-hmm. Claims or
astrology.
Astrology. Obviously everyone should. It's complete and total bullshit. It's fun, I guess, but I mean, it's about as scientifically accurate as the Ouija board. But I definitely do not find comfort. I'm not an extreme skeptic, right? Mm-hmm. That I don't think everything is unknowable. And I'm not even sure that it matters that some things are unknowable. It's fine, right? You just know, you try to learn the things you can, and you do the best you can with the information you have, and just believe those things because you have at least sufficient reason to believe them. It's better than just sitting, you know, in the dark on your couch all day. I mean, believe some stuff, right? And I would argue that even people who claim to be complete skeptics are full of shit.
So you just said believe some stuff. So believe or no?
You can use them, since I'm not really talking about just scientific, you know, knowledge or logic or something like that. I think you can use those terms colloquially a little bit interchangeable because I do understand that when I say that I know something, I am leaving open the possibility that I'm wrong. Mm-hmm. Now, it's a very small opening. Like, it's the eye of the needle, really. Good luck threading your way through that one. Because I'm very, very in love with my own beliefs and theories. But, so when I say I believe something, let's think, like, I believe the sun's going to come up tomorrow, right? I don't know that the sun is coming up tomorrow. So if I would hope that I would use the term no rigorously, but I know I don't. I use them interchangeably in a casual conversation. But if we were having a serious philosophical argument, I would definitely delineate between those two terms, mm-hmm. and I would try to be more rigorous in the way I apply them. Mm-hmm. Wow, I sound fun, don't I?
These conversations are
just, so fun.
Wow.
Yeah, you're a life of the party, buddy.
All right, so along comes someone like Augustine then.
Yeah.
Who refutes skepticism.
Kind of.
Well, by saying that God is in the mix.
Yeah, God is not a skeptic, right? You can believe in God. You shouldn't be skeptical about that.
Well, that we know things because God illuminates our minds.
So then he's appealing to what we call revealed knowledge, mm-hmm. which in my opinion is the weakest of all types of knowledge, mm-hmm. right? So you have observed knowledge, you have deduced knowledge, and you have revealed knowledge. Mm-hmm. Observed knowledge is, look, that you know that wall is yellowish, whatever, in our studio here, and I'm pretty confident that it is the wall, not the ceiling.
Yeah, I was looking. Right. I was trying to find a place where I can actually
where we
see
haven't covered it with sound wall, deadening devices. Yeah. So that's sense data, right? And we know that can be fallible. I mean, my eyes are pretty bad. Right. So I know that not to rely on my vision too overly much, but I put some faith into it. Otherwise, I couldn't leave the house. Deduced knowledge are things like logic and math, mm-hmm. where you have a set of rules that it doesn't really necessarily mean it's like this in the real world. But given a certain premise and a premises, rather, you can deduce what is true if your statements are true. Right. All chickens are birds, all roosters are chickens, therefore all roosters are birds, that type of thing. Mm-hmm. So you can deduce that and you can be very confident in that result, assuming that all chickens are birds, mm-hmm. right? So if you get one of your premises wrong, that's fine, but that's not really what logic is here for. It's really to test the form of your argument. Or I can be very confident in mathematical truths, assuming that I'm working in base 10, in standard math, and I'm not doing some kind of wacky, you know, base six bullshit math or something like that. Okay. So revealed knowledge is just some shit somebody told you.
Right.
Now, religious people think that shit is pretty reliable because they believe it's coming from God. But shit people tell you is the least reliable form of knowledge. And you could never write a paper and just say, well, you know, my brother told me this and that's my source, right?
And yet we do that all the time.
Well, that's
key. We do that all the time. We talk about, we cite our sources. We right. say, I mean, well, for this episode, I'm going to put a sure. list of articles for people to go and look and so that they know, hey, this is where we got some of these thoughts, or right. I did anyway.
So, and I would differentiate between using sources that have actually used, you know, scientific experimentation and mathematical deduction and logic, et cetera, to reach a conclusion, and then citing their work, because you can't obviously, you know, go through life recreating every argument from scratch, right? You just don't have that kind of time.
But I mean, it is in many ways, like even if you're thinking about historiography.
Yeah.
It is revealed knowledge. It's stuff that people yeah. have done the research on. They're telling you what it is.
Right.
And the thing that's interesting to me, at least, is how often that is then revised. You know, sure. it's not, nothing is monolithic. It doesn't right. just stand and there it is.
And even if you were using original sources in history, a lot of times that's also just some shit somebody's telling you, right? Mm-hmm. Maybe that person is Pliny the Elder or Plutarch, but that's just shit somebody's telling you.
And everybody comes with their own bias, right? So you can't ignore that. And that's just the truth of it.
Yeah.
In this case though of Augustine, the way I'm understanding it is it is that. It's like, you know, it's revealed knowledge, but it's the way he talks about it is interesting. It's not sort of like the word of God in the Bible, although there is that, right? I mean, there is that. But what he was saying, the quote that struck me is, the human mind is like an eye that can see when and only when God, the source of light, illumines it.
Yes.
So in this case, your experience of the world, your experience of a tree, or your experience of sitting across from me here is only, you can only see this and experience this because God has in some way worked on your mind.
Right, and revealed this to you.
To allow you, he's provided the light your mind, the spark in your mind to allow you to have this experience.
And then that argument goes further, and I don't remember whether it was Augustine or somebody else, where they said, and you can rely on it because God is no deceiver, right? That's very important, because you could just say, well, all right, God has revealed this to me, but maybe he's a big liar, right? Mm-hmm. So their argument has to include the idea that God is not a deceiver.
Right.
Because God's evil and you can't have an, you know.
Well, how would you know that, though?
Well, I mean, you don't.
You don't know that.
But they believe
it. How could they look around at the world they lived in?
Yeah.
And believe that, because so many things were bad.
Because that's their goal, is to be an apologist for God, right? To justify belief in him. It's their whole job, mm-hmm. right? So they're going to, by necessity, ignore or try to explain away, you know, certain problematic things like children getting eye cancer, where you're like, well, you know, that, what about that? And you're like, oh, you know, God has a plan. Don't worry. He mm-hmm. told me. Right?
Right. All right. So then let's talk about this. If A knows P, then A knows that A knows P.
Right. And that's very Cartesian, right? If you know something, then you know that you know it. Mm-hmm. And you know that there is someone to know it, and right? I'm here to know that.
And that refutes like a fully skeptic position, right?
Right.
Because someone who skeptics would say you don't know anything.
You don't know shit. Right.
You may think you know,
right?
But you don't know.
Yeah. So I would say that that's not a super strong argument, mm-hmm. because clearly people believe they know something when they don't. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's very evident in our present day lives, right?
Right.
But I think they had a counter to that, where they would basically kind of weasel word it and say, well, they think they know it, but deep down they know they don't really know it, you know, something like that. But I mean, I think it's a pretty unreliable, a kind of a weak argument, because we know that human knowledge is not infallible.
Okay, so there are two general categories of skeptics, and I think you kind of touched on this, but I want to underline it. There's those who deny all possibility of knowledge.
Correct.
And there are those who advocate for the suspension of judgment due to inadequacy of evidence.
Yeah. Basically say, look, recognize that you might think this is the answer, but you don't have all the knowledge, all the data, your limited brain power, whatever it is. And you have to recognize that you have to suspend full belief in a lot of these things, because you just don't know. You know, for them, one of the worst things you can do is believe something that is not true and invest in that.
So let's talk about some skeptical scenarios.
Sure.
And this is all, of course, this is all stuff that is coming out of the practice of skepticism and the ongoing academic dialogue around skepticism through time, right? Okay, yep. So there's the evil demon problem. So this is Descartes. It invokes the possibility of a being who could deliberately mislead one
yeah.
into falsely believing everything you take to be true.
Basically saying that, you know, it's a being that's more powerful than you, and they're able to trick you, like Satan, right? Satan mm-hmm. could trick you. Mm-hmm. And there's also that argument, which is kind of a sister argument, which is that being would also be able to convince you that they are a deity. Mm-hmm. Right? They're just sufficiently more powerful than you. So you trust and believe everything they say. Mm-hmm. Or they could just directly trick you, like Armand.
Yeah. He was a vampire from Interview with Vamp. We're having a little crossover between our...
No extra charge.
Our podcast. Okay. Then there is the brain in a vat hypothesis.
Right. That's sort of a matrixy thing, I believe. Basically, you believe you're out here experiencing the world. I've grabbed my microphone and trying not to make too much noise to annoy Christina. I tasted the Coke I drank about 30 seconds ago. I'm directly doing all that. But maybe not. Maybe I'm just a brain in a vat, and these impulses are being fed into my brain to make me think I'm doing all these things. But really, I'm just a brain in a vat. I'm in the matrix. Mm-hmm. So I'm plugged in. They're making me think I'm going through all these things, but really, I'm just a brain in a vat.
And since a brain in a vat would have no way of knowing that it was a brain in a vat, you cannot prove that you are not a brain in a vat.
That's correct. You cannot.
Then there's the dream argument. This is...
Right. You don't know... Like, dreams seem very real to us. Mm-hmm. When you're in the dream, for the most part, you don't really realize that you are dreaming. Mm-hmm. So when you, quote unquote, wake up, how do you know you're not still dreaming?
Right.
Right? You can pinch yourself. Well, great. You can pinch yourself in a dream, too. You can walk around. You can walk around in a dream. So dreams can simulate reality. So there's really no sure way of knowing whether or not, quote unquote, reality is also just another kind of dream.
All right. So the dream argument was proposed by Descartes and mm-hmm. also Zhuangzi, an Eastern
Chinese
philosopher. Yep. Mm-hmm. Okay. Then there's the 5-minute hypothesis, which was proposed by Bertrand Russell. And it suggests that we cannot prove that the world was not created 5 minutes ago.
Correct. You could, I mean, if you think about it, this is similar to the young Earth Christian argument, right? Mm. Yes, the world looks old. Yes, things look like they're aged, but really it was created 5,000 years ago. And mm-hmm. it the evidence is implanted in the earth. And in the 5-minute hypothesis, all of our memories are just implanted into us. And we just think that we've been around for 58 years, when in reality, it's only been 5 minutes. Right. So I don't know if I have to get my driver's license changed or how that works.
All right. So then there's the sim. And you see why we're talking through these because of, you know,
they're questioning base reality.
Right. And so then so his idea does not just come up out of nowhere.
Oh, no.
All right. All right. So then there's the simulated reality hypothesis, or the matrix hypothesis, which suggests that everyone or even the entire universe might be inside a computer simulation or virtual reality, which is basically, I guess, his argument.
Yes.
Is that. And then there's the solipsistic theory that claims that knowledge of the world is an illusion of the self.
Right. So solipsists basically disbelieve everything other than themselves. Mm-hmm. So they would say, Christina, you seem very nice, but I also know you're fake. Like you are completely imaginary, and you are just here to serve as a kind of a ghost in my dream, you know, sort of thing, where I'm the only real thing. Mm-hmm. Nobody else is real, and therefore probably don't matter that much.
And I mean, okay, so Descartes is almost at that kind of.
Well, that's where he goes
initially.
As an exercise, right? Mm-hmm. And at no point did Descartes really think that solipsism was a valid, philosophy.
Right.
But he does do that as part of his cogito argument, where he basically says, okay, everybody's all confused about what's real, what's not real. Here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to disbelieve everything. I'm rejecting all knowledge, all experience, all sense data, and I'm going to build back up and see what I end up with. So, his first step is to go, okay, what do I know? What do I know? If I'm asking that question, there is an I, right? Because otherwise, who could ask the question? Mm-hmm. Nobody. So, if I'm able to ask the question, what do I know? I exist. I don't know what form I exist in, but I definitely do exist, because otherwise there would be no question to ask. I couldn't say that I wonder this, I think that, whatever, because I mean, I know I exist. I'm real. So he starts from there, and then he, you know, kind of tries to build the rest of the universe up from there.
So why do you think, let's have a little conversation before we move on to what Nick Bostrom's premise and conclusion are. Why throughout time have people questioned reality?
Well, that's a good question.
There are not everybody does. I don't think that everybody questions reality, but when I was young, when I was little, I used to think I was a very odd kid. Well, and maybe when I share this with you,
I'll agree.
You'll agree that I was an odd kid, or it just kind of tracks with who I am. But I can remember sitting in classes and whatever, I wasn't paying attention to what was going on in class. Instead, I was looking at my hand and I was thinking, like, hands are strange. What are hands for? Like, why
is my hand... having a dissociative event there.
I think I was like kind of going down this path without really realizing like is this real? That was kind of like always in my I always had this idea of like, is this real? Like, am I real?
I mean, when you say it's a certain kind of person, basically you have to be someone who is, you know, somewhat of a deep thinker. They're contemplative.
Self-reflective, right?
Exactly.
Right.
And I think the origin of these kinds of discussions came from the fact that we do have differing views of reality. Right. You can find that out in just everyday experience where someone will say, you know, cilantro is delicious. And you're like, it tastes like soap, bro. You know, and you just have these little differences in the way you perceive the world. And then, of course, they are multiplied when you get to things like belief systems and ethics, et cetera. So they do start to say, how can everybody have a different view of the world from me? Which I'm shocked by every single day.
I just we're colliding more with different views now.
Absolutely.
Thanks to social media.
Yeah, so you're now interacting with people you probably would never have a conversation with, and now you can fight with them online.
100%.
Yeah.
Okay, well, let's move on now and talk about Nick Bostrom's premise and conclusion. So this is a little bit lengthy, but I'm going to read it, and then we can kind of dig into what our thoughts are on this. Okay, so this is his premise. Many works of science fiction, as well as some forecasts by serious technologists and futurologists, predict that enormous amounts of computing power will be available in the future. Let us suppose for a moment that these predictions are correct. One thing that later generations might do with their super powerful computers is run detailed simulations of their forebears or of people like their forebears. Because their computers would be so powerful, they could run a great many such simulations. Suppose that these simulated people are conscious, as they would be if the simulations were sufficiently fine-grained and if a certain quite widely accepted position in the philosophy of the mind is correct. Then it could be the case that the vast majority of minds like ours do not belong to the original race, but rather to the people simulated by the advanced descendants of an original race.
Right.
So that's his premise. And then his conclusion is this. It is then possible to argue that if this were the case, we would be rational to think that we are likely among the simulated minds rather than among the original biological ones. Therefore, if we don't think that we are currently living in a computer simulation, we are not entitled to believe that we will have descendants who will run lots of such simulations of their forebears.
Basically, and it's a probabilistic discussion, right? Mm-hmm. So if this is possible, which we have reason to believe that it is possible because
we're already starting to run simulations.
Sure.
They're not super sophisticated. I mean, they are sophisticated.
Compared to what was before.
Like this.
Like, if I went back to 1910 and showed them a game of FIFA, they would be stunned at how realistic that is, right?
Right.
And how realistic the football is. Because it's a pretty good simulation. Or if I showed them even something scarier, like Modern Warfare, right? Where you're realistic looking guys running around killing each other. Mm-hmm. And it does look fairly convincing. Or like a flight simulator. I remember we had those back in the 80s, right? Mm-hmm. And it's real enough that it fools your body into thinking that you're experiencing it.
Well, the rides, for instance, those rides at Disney World that you don't even have to have roller coasters anymore, where you actually even move anywhere.
Right, like the Star Wars ride.
You're just rocking around in your seat
with a video screen,
yeah.
Right? And it's sufficiently convincing that you get seasick.
Yeah.
You do. No, I'm telling you, you do.
No, I definitely do. No, 100% I do.
Yeah.
But okay, so we are right now doing things that are simulated, that are pretty sophisticated.
Yeah.
There's still an uncanny valley thing with the way that video game characters look.
Sure.
They don't look quite right. You know, their mouths don't look quite right in their teeth. There's something not quite right.
Right.
So it's not tricksy enough. But I've never done like VR.
So I've done a VR roller coaster. And this is, keep in mind, this isn't even like as sophisticated as the Star Wars rides at Disney where they're moving your seat around. This is you sitting in a plastic library chair with this VR headset on, and you're going through a roller coaster. And it, after a while, your body feels those turns. Mm-hmm. You're wrong. You're not turning, but your body, your brain gets tricked into thinking that you are doing those turns, mm-hmm. and you feel it just as if you were really doing turns. And it doesn't matter a ton how realistic the picture is, as long as the motion is smoothly simulated, right? And you're like, holy shit, I'm definitely on a roller coaster. Mm-hmm. And you've seen, you know, video, funny videos of people who are wearing VR who are walking like on a balance beam or something and fall off. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, they lose their balance because they feel like they're on a balance beam. And then they freak out and end up crashing into their television and break it or something like that.
Okay, so what we know is that we were just watching a I don't know what it was, like some kind of documentary or something before we started recording, where they were talking about how fast computers have become.
Right.
And in 50 years, they've like trillions and hundreds of trillions of times faster what they were than the fastest original computer.
Right.
It stands to reason that they will become even more sophisticated and faster and able to do more, crazier things, even in another 50 years, probably even faster than that. Because I think as time goes on, the rate of improvement of the technology accelerates, right?
Right. So there was, I don't remember the name of the theory, but there's this idea that computing power doubles every 6 months or a year or whatever it is, mm-hmm. right? And it's held pretty true. Although now it's slowed a bit just because there are some physical limitations mm-hmm. of the chip size and things like that that we haven't really overcome. But, you know, it's not hard to project that into the future. I mean, computers have been around, 50, 60, 80 years? I always think that like we're in the year 2000, like, you know, 100 years, let's just say 100 years, right?
Well, they haven't been around 100 years. Well,
some kinds of computers have, but not like, you know,
yeah,
video-based computers. Yeah. Those were started in the 50s, I guess. But, you know, and it's only been that long. So even just pick a small amount of time in the history of the universe, like minuscule, 500 years. And the amount, and because that, the change in computing power is geometric over a fairly short period of time, you can imagine that being just world-changingly different in 500 years, right, assuming we don't blow ourselves up.
Okay, so what he's concluding then, because I think that makes sense, and I mm-hmm. guess listeners, you'll have to say to yourselves whether or not this makes sense, that computers, our ability to create even more realistic video games or whatever else, virtual reality, right, is going to continue to progress along with our ability to create these faster and faster computers. So what he's essentially saying is, if you think that is possible to happen, if you believe that computers are going to get faster and that more, you know, more lifelike video games are going to be able to be created, then you must believe that their ability to do a simulation is true. If you don't believe that the simulation is possible, then you can't believe that things are going to progress, right?
So, yeah. So, but there are some assumptions you have to make. This is very similar to the Fermi paradox, right? Mm-hmm. Which is, you know, speculating on the existence of intelligent life and why we haven't seen it. But there's a long formula that determines, estimates, whatever, the probability and how many intelligent civilizations there are in the universe. So you start with things like, how likely is it that there's a life-supporting planet in a solar system? Okay, whatever, 50%, let's say. So 50% times, how likely is it that life has sprung up on that planet. Say that's also 50%. So now you're at 25% to having, you know, half the planets in the, half the solar systems have a planet that have a 50% chance of having life. So you're like 25% of there being all these other civilizations. And you continue to build this these probabilities, but you have to make a lot of assumptions along the way. So the universe is whatever, 15 billion years old, right? So that's given some star systems plenty of time to develop civilizations that could theoretically be hundreds of millions of years old, billions of years old even, mm-hmm. which would then make you think, okay, maybe there is a chance that they could advance computing to such a ridiculous point where they could simulate something like a universe. Mm-hmm. But you have to make a lot of assumptions along the way. You have to assume that it's at all likely that a civilization would last that long without extinguishing itself in some way. We don't know. You have to assume that there's not something physically in the universe that would prevent that civilization from achieving that kind of computing power. So, because you can't just like run this on a MacBook Pro, you mm-hmm. know, I mean, you have to have a computer of enormous speed, power, and size, right?
Well, yes, but also you said that one of the things that is slowing progress down now slightly is the size and yes. the ability to, you know, like the physical sure. capabilities with chips and things.
Right.
Assume that that then is overcome.
Sure. So the only thing then holding you back are some fundamental characteristics of the universe as we know it. Right. Mm-hmm. Let's assume that base reality is light can't travel faster than 300,000 kilometers per whatever it is hour. Let's assume that the Planck length is a real thing, which is basically just the smallest size anything can possibly be. Right. So you'd need to be able to make chips that are made up of Planck length, you know, sized things that, you know, process information at least light speed. But it is possible, absolutely possible, that a sufficiently advanced civilization could overcome those problems. We don't know how likely it is, but the argument is that there are so many, I mean, there's a quintillion planets, right? And there's we've had 15 billion years to work with. The argument is that those numbers are so large that the likelihood is that, yes, there are civilizations that are old and advanced enough to do this, and that they've had time to formulate these simulations. It's a reasonable argument. It does rely on a lot of assumptions, but it is a reasonable argument to make.
So, you know, also what I hear you doing is talking about it, and it makes sense that you're talking about it this way, as a civilization that's out there.
Right.
And the thing is that if we are a simulation, we are also out there.
Right. So it's possible that they're outside of what we think of as the universe, right?
Right.
A snow globe.
This is actually out there. It's mm-hmm. just this is the simulation.
Right.
He's arguing that time will progress and our ancestors, no, our
descendants.
He's arguing that our descendants will run simulations to about us, and that we are actually in the past.
Which is a little self-centered, I think. Like, let's say you had achieved this power, right? You could run a simulation of whatever you want. Are you just going to recreate your family tree and watch them play around?
Might be that's one of the questions, right? So there are questions that people have asked about his premise, and we'll get to that probably more in detail, but that's an interesting one to maybe dig into, is what's so interesting about us that right. that people would do it. And the thing that I, as a historian,
yes,
I absolutely get that. Yeah. I absolutely 100% get that. And I would make the argument, it is not the same. I recognize that this is not the same. But I would make the argument that any historical film that's made is really kind of us as humans wanting to
replay
something that happened in the past. There's something that people get out of that. People, yeah. you don't. and I know that many people aren't as interested in history, obviously, as I am. But there are a lot of people that are interested in elements of history. I always, as someone would say to me, you know, if I say to them, oh, I studied, it was when I was studying history. Oh, I study history. I'm getting a PhD in history. They would say, I love history. And I would know that the very next words, the words coming out of their mouths would be, I'm so fascinated by World War II.
Right.
And to me, who studies medieval history, and certainly the
You're like, psh, that's barely I'm like, that's even history, not even bro. History.
That's a history that's of like, 5 minutes
yeah,
ago.
Yeah, that's like last week's paper.
True. So, but there are people who are interested in history. So, you know, so you see World War II movies, you see movies about all of the kings of England, you know, and particularly Henry VIII or Queen Elizabeth or whatever else, right? So there is that.
But you are, Bostrom is relying on the existence of very large numbers, right? So let's say it's very unlikely someone would run a simulation recreating their past, but it's pretty likely that at least one person will, mm-hmm. right? So are you familiar with the infinite monkeys and infinite typewriters joke?
Yes, yeah, so that if you had a sufficient number of monkeys and a sufficient number of typewriters, they would accidentally recreate the works of Shakespeare.
So my dad used to tell a joke. It's not a great joke because it's a dad joke, but I'm going to tell the joke and you decide whether you're going to leave it in or not. So scientists in the far future have decided, you know what? We have the resources. We're going to test the infinite monkey theory. So they get a fuck ton of monkeys. Not an infinite number of monkeys, but a lot, like more monkeys that even exist on the planet right now. They get them all together. They give them all typewriters because, you know, this joke was made in the 50s. Mm-hmm. So there's typewriters. And then they let them go crazy for 8 to 10 hours a day, and they check the results. And they have tons of lab assistants running around reading things. And day after day, the papers, these sheets of paper are just full of bullshit, right? It's just like random letters and keys stuck together and a lot of punctuation that doesn't belong. And they're just going and going and going. They're getting kind of discouraged. And then one day, a young research assistant goes, I found something. And they all come running over. He's like, what's it say? What's it say? He's like, hold on. To be or not to be. That is the Gazornin plots. So my dad has probably told us that joke 100 times. Mm-hmm. He loved that joke. Right. But that just shows kind of the irony of, you know, this kind of way of thinking and the limits of the power of large numbers. So, but what Bostrom is really relying on are very, very, very large numbers, mm-hmm. right? If you have a quintillion planets and that yields a trillion civilizations, right? That's a lot. That's a lot of civilizations. And if that civilization doesn't have just 5,000 years or 10,000 years, which seems unimaginably long for us for a civilization to exist, but billions of years. Mm-hmm. So you have all these civilizations, which, by the way, probably have billions and billions of inhabitants, all of whom are sufficiently advanced to create these things. He's basically saying odds are somebody's going to do this kind of simulation.
And he's not, again, you're really placing it out there. And you're taking,
well, it's wherever.
You're taking into consideration the fact that his numbers include these massive numbers of potential life-bearing planets.
Well, that's a stronger argument for him.
But he's not even going that far. He's just saying that based on how fast we're advancing here on Earth, that at some point, and maybe at some point we won't have Earth anymore. Maybe Earth, right. will, you know, our descendants will be on some other planet, and by necessity, because we fucked up this one. Well, maybe that's why they're running a simulation to see how we fucked up. Who knows? It could just be one person who says, okay, you know, this is a really great video game. You can run a simulation and see all of your ancestors from the, you know, the beginning of time to now and see how it all looks. I mean, and he's really talking about just our ability, as far as I'm understanding, what I read from his premise here, and I haven't read his whole paper or anything like that, but just from what I've read in his premise is that it's our descendants here that just our computing power becomes so great that we're able to, that they are able to create these simulations. And if you are a person who believes that the computing power will continue, you must then also believe that it is possible that humans will develop the ability to do this kind of an in-depth simulation.
And it's certainly possible. The tricky part is there's a little leap you have to make. You can say, yes, it's very likely that a simulation could exist that is closely replicates or identically replicates our current view of the universe and existence, right? Mm-hmm. It could look just like, to all the simulated people in it, could look just like our universe looks to us. Mm-hmm. But that's a different thing from saying, and it's you. You're in the simulation. Because you could be, but you also could not be. There's nothing about that theory that says humans, as they appear to exist right now, aren't actually real and living in the universe, right? And while there are people out there making these giant simulations, it doesn't follow necessarily that you're one of them. It's possible.
Wait, what do you mean?
If our ancestors decided to, well, I mean, you have to assume that it's ancestors. I don't think that that's a reasonable.
Descendants, you mean?
I mean, our descendants. I don't think that's a reasonable assumption because you're making it very specific and you're basically begging the question by saying, okay, our descendants create this simulation. Well, by necessity, you're now saying we don't exist anymore. Right, except in this simulation, which I think is begging the question of his hypothesis. So let's assume it's not necessarily descendants, it's just some other creatures wherever, whenever, who are able to make these simulations either now or in the future. It doesn't follow necessarily that we're in it. We could be in it, and we probably wouldn't know the difference if we were, but we could also not be in it. Right, it would be very possible for some advanced civilization that manages to create these simulations, and they have a giant computer running somewhere that's doing it. But we could also still just normally exist.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
And I think that's where he and I would diverge in the wood, mm-hmm. right? And he's taking the path more crazy. But it is possible, and it's certainly worth exploring as a philosophical idea and a metaphysical discussion. But I think that's where the breakdown might be. Because I think his assumption that that it's our descendants assumes that we're no longer here and we are in a simulation. So that's what I call, that's begging the question.
Yeah, but
right? you're assuming your conclusion, you know, before you've proven your theory. So he's assuming, now, is it possible that we could be that exact thing? Our descendants are the ones running the simulation. We're faux people, mm-hmm. right? And we're unwitting.
But we're conscious.
Steve's in the, right.
We'd be conscious. We'd be conscious artificial intelligence.
Sure, yeah. And which we also assume is technologically possible because really there's nothing in the metaphysics of the universe that says intelligent life has to be contained in a wet, squishy gray mass inside the skull of a sack of protoplasm.
Or right? that the brain is something that couldn't be
simulated. Sure. So again, I think that it's perfectly reasonable to assume that at some point civilization might, or maybe already has, can achieve true artificial intelligence that is self-aware. Mm-hmm. Sure. I'll buy that.
So this actually is a good time to shift on away from his, we're still going to be rooted in mm-hmm. his hypothesis, but now let's talk about, once he put that out there, as often happens, different conversations sprung up around it.
Sure.
And so let's talk about the kinds of simulations that people posit we could be we could be experiencing. There's his that our descendants have created.
They're running like a historical recreation.
Yeah.
That we're basically Colonial Williamsburg.
Or, like we're living history to them or whatever, you know, and like so you're
we're the Hall of Presidents.
Right. And
yes. You missed, now, unfortunately for you, this is an audio-only podcast, and you missed my mechanical presidential speech.
Oh, God. All right.
Poor score.
Oh, boy. Yeah. All right. Then the other is that we're like, the universe is a simulation controlled by something external to it. So, so his would be, this universe for us is inside of a computer.
It's a snow globe.
It's a snow globe. There's also, the universe is a simulation controlled by something external to it. So it's like, that would be kind of like outside of Earth or outside of us as a civilization. There's something outside of us that's controlling this simulation.
Something exists outside of the simulation that's controlling the simulation.
And that doesn't necessarily have to be us. Then there's, you know, you take that. The next logical step there, is that the creators of the simulation are aliens, are as you were saying, like, you know,
some advanced civilization.
Right. So to me, that simulation makes less sense, because if you're questioning why would our descendants be interested in what we're doing, why would aliens be interested in creating a universe of us?
I'll answer that question for you.
All right.
You like playing Minecraft?
Yeah, but that's very human.
Well, but do you like playing Minecraft?
Yes.
Have you ever played like Civ or Ancient Civilizations or whatever? These are basically simulation games where you're like, okay, I'm going to start off in the Stone Age, right? And I'm going to progress. And it's interesting, right? It's entertaining. And that it is possible that to them, where time may be very, very different to them, right? A billion years is not a big deal, or a million years is nothing, right? And, you know, computing power is, you know, just almost unlimited. And they could say, look, we're going to give this a shot. We're going to create our own universe. We're going to give it some basic rules. We're going to seed it with some matter and energy and some physical laws. And we're going to turn it loose, and we're going to see what happens, which is really parallels kind of the watchmaker theory of deists, right?
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. It's interesting how this comes back around. And now we've got, remember I've said this to you. We had a paradigm shift during the time of the scientific revolution, and all explanations went from being religious explanations to scientific explanations.
Right.
Now, and I said to you, what happens when there's another paradigm shift?
Right.
And this could be,
I'm hoping it's magic. Hope that we can get wands and stuff.
Kind of that this could be a paradigm shift, right? Like if enough people really started getting on this, and there were, you know, proofs happening and things like that, this could create quite a paradigm shift, because at some point we as conscious AI in whatever this simulation is, and that kind of simulation wouldn't be something where they're actually still involved in controlling it. That's not a video game.
They set the initial conditions and let it go.
That would be different from our descendants running a simulation to see what their ancestors did, right?
Correct.
So in that case, you're reinventing God.
Right. Basically, I mean, it's certainly something that approaches that level of omnipotence, right?
Yeah.
Now, you know, God is a very particular concept currently. I mean, gods used to be just like really powerful people who were just as big a dicks as humans are. But theology is at the point now where everyone feels like God, in whatever form they believe in them, him, her, it, is an all, you know, the three omnis, right? Mm-hmm. Omnipotent, omniscient, and omnipresent. No, omnipotent, omniscient, and omnibenevolent. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Basically can do anything. They know everything. They're everywhere. And that's a very tricky philosophical idea, which I think has some serious flaws.
Well, right. But there are the deists who believe who in the Watchmaker. Right.
Basically, God, set up the universe, turned it on, and then moved on to like building train sets or Legos or something.
Yeah, just or maybe checks back in and just kind of sees where like, it's going.
These fucking guys.
Yeah, just you know, and that would be, but then that is not an obviously is not a god.
They're like, or it's a been,
creator
it's
who's
been 15 billion years and they haven't figured out how to make plant-based food taste good yet.
It's been 15 billion years and they can't figure out how to get along.
Well, that too.
You know,
sure. But here's, so in addition to being skeptical, but not extremely skeptical, I also think I'm a bit pragmatic in my belief system. So let's say that one of these theories of the simulation is correct. Here's my question. So what? We can't get out of the simulation, right? We're part of it. You can't escape the simulation. Right? It's not the Matrix. You can't just unplug your head. Chances are you only exist in the simulation. There's no way to get out of it. It's your entire universe. And there are limits put in place so that you can't go beyond the edge of it, right? Because we have limited lifetimes and you can only travel up to the speed of light and all kinds of other physical limitations. So what? So live your life. You're a simulation. Big whoop.
Well, and I want to dive into thoughts like that probably in a future episode. Yeah. But because it's valid. It's the right questions to be asking, and people are asking those questions. That is a part of the dialogue around this. Okay. Finally, before we wrap up for this episode, let's talk about who some of the proponents of this theory or this hypothesis are. Obviously, we know, I'm not going to be able to, there's not this exhaustive list, but there's somebody who's pretty significant.
So I'll tell you a couple of them that I know what their positions are.
Okay.
Neil deGrasse Tyson, it's 50-50.
Yeah.
He thinks it's about a coin flip whether we're in a simulation or not.
He has tempered that slightly. Right. There's been, I guess he's got a friend called J. Richard Gott, who's a professor of astrophysical sciences at Princeton. And he made him aware of a strong objection. And that objection claims that the common trait that all hypothetical high fidelity simulated universes possess is the ability to produce high fidelity simulated universes. And being that our current world does not possess that ability, it would mean that either we are the real universe and therefore simulated universes have yet to be created, or we are the last in a very long chain of simulated universes, and an observation that makes the simulation hypothesis seem less probable.
I'd have to give that some thought.
That's not as strong of an argument to me, but anyway, Tyson he's paying attention. He's downgraded, but he really for some time was very much a proponent, and I think still maybe.
Yeah, I think. I mean, look, it's an intriguing idea, and you certainly have to allow for the possibility. Mm-hmm. Here's a ding dong who thinks it's absolutely true.
Elon Musk.
Yeah. So that fucking guy.
I guess it's one time that I kind of agree with him.
The CEO of Exeter. Or whatever he's calling it these days, says it's almost impossible we're not in a simulation. First of all, who the fuck are you? You with your pretend physics degree.
No, he does have one.
No, he doesn't. He doesn't have a physics degree.
He does.
He doesn't have
a physics degree.
He was awarded some honorary degrees. He did not complete his engineering degree. He was maybe awarded an honorary physics degree. He has put that story out there. He doesn't have a degree. And people who have worked with him have said he doesn't understand technology. He understands business, right? And he understands yelling at engineers enough to get them to produce it. I am almost positive he does not have a degree. I think he's just lied about that. So I mean, first of all, he's certainly not a qualified theoretical physicist. He's not a good philosopher.
But you know what? You got to give him this. And I'm not a fan.
I'm not going to give him much.
I'm not a fan. But he definitely thinks outside of the box. He definitely does. It doesn't always work, but he definitely thinks outside of the box.
And
so I think having the ability to do that, to be more of a gray Shades of Grey thinker, allows him maybe to, I don't know, feel confident about
unusual things. He certainly feels confident, right? He definitely is a very confident person, except probably he's got an inferiority-superiority complex, would be my guess. I mean, he complains to his engineers that his tweets aren't getting enough likes.
Yeah, right? But you just really jumped on this hating Elon
because
Musk.
Because I think there's a lot of reason to hate him. He's a shitty guy. Okay. Right? He puts forth conspiracy theories. He lies, right, about his intentions. He's like, I want to make this a free speech platform. I want everybody to have, then he amplifies conspiracy theory.
All right, let's move on from him. So who else do you have?
Michio Kaku. This guy.
Oh, yeah, I've seen him.
Yeah, he's a very famous physicist. I think he entertains the possibility and talks a lot about how consciousness affects quantum theory, which is very kind of supportive of simulation theory, because why would it, right, otherwise? Mm-hmm. But I think he's ultimately skeptical. But no, I don't know anybody else, so you tell me who else.
All right, Australian techno-philosopher David Chalmers.
Okay.
I mean, he's out there, he's doing TED Talks and things like that. And he, for Chalmers, virtual reality worlds will be or are just as real as any world, including this one, which might itself be virtually simulated. So, you know, what's the difference? One way he attempts to convince you of this is by appealing to your understanding of reality. And he says, picture a tree. It seems solid, very there, very present, but as any physicist will tell you, at the subatomic level,
right, it's mostly space.
It's mostly empty space. It's barely there at all. And so he writes, few people think that the mere fact that trees are grounded in quantum processes makes them less real, Chalmers writes. I think that being digital is just like being quantum mechanical here. So he's getting down to, you know, as you just said, sort of the quantum level.
Yes.
And others are doing that too. And we'll talk more about how people are testing this in another episode, but they're looking to try and get down to the very sort of building blocks of things to see, like, are we X's or are we O's and ones, right? Yeah. Like, are we made up of like little pixels?
So I don't think it's, and I would quibble a little bit with his characterization of the tree hardly being there, because it's not like there isn't stuff there. It's just not, you know, our perception of base reality isn't, you know, direct.
Right. Well, it goes back to your comment earlier that we all experience things differently. Sure. But the thing is that we all experience trees as being there and being solid.
Well, and they are there.
But the reality is there's just a lot of empty space.
There is. But there's also, in a human, there's a billion, billion, billion atoms. That's not nothing. Now, those atoms are very small, and there is proportionately a lot of space between them. But it's not really correct for him to say it's barely there, right? A billion, billion, billion atoms is a lot.
Well, he's using it to illustrate a point. Yeah. So he's overstating.
Crikey.
Oh, cut it out. I guess maybe let's wrap up there.
Yeah.
What do you want to say to kind of wrap up this episode and in conclusion? What are your,
so first,
as a jumping off for some next episodes, which are going to be digging more into, you know, how people are saying this maybe is, you know, we'll talk more about how they're trying to test it. Because I saw something where someone said, what do scientists, that was a question like on Quora, or whatever.
Source of infinite numbers of bullshit theories. Yeah.
So it said, are scientists trying to prove the simulation theory? And someone wrote in, no scientists are doing this because it's pseudoscience. Scientists are taking it seriously. That's not accurate.
No, but it has to be theoretical because it's not an evidentiary claim, in my opinion. There's no, you can't imagine a set of circumstances that would serve to prove it wrong, right? Because you can always just say, well, I can prove it wrong if I can, you know, achieve the speed of light or something like that. And they could just say, well, that's just a feature of the simulation, right? So there's no way to prove it wrong. Now, there, it's also very difficult, possibly impossible. Did I just say that? potentially impossible to prove it right. So I don't think it's an evidentiary claim.
Maybe, but we're also going to talk about the ways that people think things happen that actually prove the simulation that we can see. Fair. And then I'd like to talk to you about what you said, which is sort of like, what difference would it make? Like, make a difference? And for some people, some thinkers have argued that it does. It makes a big difference. It could potentially make a big difference if all of a sudden we realize that none of this is real. Right. And so we've got a lot of good topics to talk about. I'm not sure that it'll be immediately our next episode because this subject is big. And it's, you know, we've got to do some actual research.
Plus we might lose all of our listeners.
No, I don't think so.
I think it's interesting. Usually, it's a very interesting.
Usually our listeners are interested in when we do these kinds of episodes. Yeah. So, all right. Well, leaving it there then for now. Why don't we talk about social media?
Sure.
We have a Twitter. We are at extemporaneous2. I am at Christina Gen X. Mark is at Mark Eats Peach. And we have a Facebook group. Come and join us there. And if you do like us, we'd really appreciate it if you would share us with a friend. I'm going to say bye.
Peace out, simulated Cub Scouts.
It's always something.
It is always something.